Welcome to Still Scared Talking Children's Horror, a podcast about creepy, spooky, and disturbing children's books, films, and TV. I'm Ren Wednesday, my co-host is Adam Wybray, and today we're talking about the 1962 novel The Wolves of Willoughby Chase by Joan Aiken. A full transcript of this episode will be available, so check the show notes for that. Enjoy! Good evening, Adam.
Evening, and welcome to the Bonnie Green fan club.
Ooh, oh, she's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I particularly enjoyed her spirited pluckiness and willingness to throw water in the face of monstrous authority figures.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So Bonnie is the one of the two protagonists of The Wolves of Willoughby Chase. By Joan Aiken.
Published in 1962, but set in 1832 in an alternative version of England.
With wolves.
With wolves, yeah.
if this version of England had a log line, it would be, what if Victorian England, but wolves?
Yeah. I think the differences between actual Victorian England and this version become more apparent in the sequels.
Okay.
But they're not particularly elaborated on in this. There's quite a number of sequels.
I was going to say, there's a good half a dozen, aren't there?
Yeah.
I mean, she was quite prolific. It said on Wikipedia she wrote over 100 books. The ones I know her for are the Arabella Mortimer books.
Oh, okay.
Mostly because my brother was terrified of the television adaptation when we were kids.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know if you ever saw it. It was...
No.
So it's about a girl with kind of bushy hair whose best friend is a raven.
Uh-huh.
Called Mortimer, who just says nevermore lots of times. And they get into various scrapes. But my brother generally was quite scared of puppets as a kid.
Mm.
And yeah, these particular puppets, I don't know if it was the same company who did the Spooks of Bottle Bay, which we'll definitely have to talk about another time on this podcast, but they had quite large noses, I remember.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, my brother really didn't like it.
That's right, run away, run away. I'll get that bird. You see if I don't.
Oddly, despite, you know, me generally being scared of everything as a kid, I was quite fond of it.
Oh, well, that's a change.
Yeah, it's a very friendly raven.
I read The Wolves of Willoughby Chase as a kid. Ah. I think I had my mum's copy from the 60s or 70s. And I read the sequel, the first sequel, Black Hearts in Battersea.
It's a great title.
Oh, yeah. No, I remember it being really good, actually. There's lots of eerie cobbled streets and escaping in a hot air balloon and things. So I think we might have to come back to that one.
And looking at some of the books, some of them were described as steampunk, interestingly. So presumably this has sort of been applied after the fact, essentially.
Yes.
But yeah, I found that interesting. Victorian, various Victorian industrial cities like Manchester and London, and often...
Yeah.
Yeah, a focus on big machines and transportation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Although Wolves of Willoughby Chase doesn't start in the city.
No, it begins with young Sylvia, who's the other protagonist, leaving her elderly Aunt Jane behind to go and stay with her cousin Bonnie at the grand countryside estate of Willoughby Chase, as Bonnie's parents are going away on a sea voyage for her mother's health. The countryside is so overrun with wolves that the train has to make a sudden stop in the station. The gentleman sharing Sylvia's carriage gets knocked down by his own luggage. So they end up taking him back to the chase with Sylvia to recuperate. This is my quite pared down version of the plot, but we can go into more detail. But just to give folks an idea. So while Lord Willoughby is away, he's engaged a distant cousin, Miss Slycarp, to act as governess to the girls and look after the estate. However, as soon as the parents are gone, Miss Slycarp reveals that she doesn't have the slightest interest in teaching or children or anything apart from reaping all of the wealth of the estate for herself.
I don't know. I think to be fair, she's quite interested in sadism as well.
No, that's true. Yeah.
You know, let's not simplify her character. she does enjoy a bit of the being horrible to children.
Yes. Yeah, I think that is one of her passions. she does things like lock Bonnie in a cupboard. But they discover a secret passage in the house and sort of start creeping around it and overhear Miss Slycarp talking to the gentleman from the train, Mr. Grimshaw, about forging a new will for Lord Willoughby. And they realise that these two had known each other all along and had cooked up this plan for him to get brought to the estate with Sylvia. They try to send a note to the doctor asking for help, but it's intercepted. And when Miss Slycarp finds out their plans, she packs them off to the industrial and very Dickensian city of Blastburn, to the orphanage run by her friend, Mrs. Brisket.
If you're wondering about Mr. Brisket, according to the film, she made soap out of him.
He was drowned in a vat of lye by his wife and made into poor quality soap for the orphans to wash with.
If you want to know where Fight Club stole its ideas from.
So Mrs. Brisket is just a shadier character as Miss Slycarp and runs this sort of illegal workhouse masquerading as a school. Where the two girls are forced into drudgery. Then that Bonnie finds out that the ship her parents were on has sunk and her parents are assumed dead. But they are rescued from all of this miserable horror by Simon, who is a boy who lives in the woods on the Willoughby Chase estate. He breaks them.
And what a boy!
I love Simon. I thought, like, in the film, I thought, I'm going to enjoy this film when, like, pretty much the first shot is Simon, like, throwing a goose at the floor. I don't know if you noticed that, but like
I didn't notice.
He had to
that,
like no. He had a goose in his arms. Instead of putting it down, he just like threw it.
I like that. This is a surefire indication you're going to enjoy a film with goose throwing.
I thought it showed it had character. he breaks them out of the orphanage and they travel to London and there's a bunch of sleuthing around as they find out the truth about Miss Slycarp and that she forged her way into the governess role at Willoughby Chase. And They eventually make it back to the house, only to find that Miss Slycarp has turned it into a cruel and abusive school with Mrs. Brisket. They pretend that they've come back with their tails between their legs to beg for forgiveness, but actually they've turned up with some police and then even Lord and Lady Willoughby, who it turns out hadn't drowned but had survived the shipwreck floating on a raft and eating bananas
and grapes,
yes, and the shock to the system and the vitamin C had apparently cured Lady Willoughby, and she was back to her bright and bubbly self. So the conniving adults are arrested, and all is returned to how it should be.
Yeah, it's a thoroughly happy ending.
It is. and unlike in the film, it sort of, the horror kind of winds down quite a lot from when Simon breaks them out of the orphanage. Sort of things are,
yeah, I think that's
a fairly calm. I mean,
yeah, I'd say the film only winds down in the last 2 minutes.
Yeah, it has a very hectic last 10 minutes.
oh yeah, you haven't seen the last of the wolves. I think they felt that, you know, the title of the film is The Wolves of Willoughby Chase, and while these wolves may also be metaphorical, you know, you gotta give the kids what they want.
Yes.
Which is a load of wolves.
Plenty. Plenty of big fluffy wolves.
Yeah. I didn't check if there were any wolf wranglers listed in the credits.
Oh yeah.
Presumably. Shit. I think that only stays in my mind because I remember when we saw that terrible Mel Gibson film. don't worry, we sort of snuck in. We bought tickets for a different film,
yeah,
and then went to see The Beaver. And I just remember that on the credits it had Puppet Wrangler.
Oh, that's where that was from. I'd forgotten the context, but the phrase Puppet Wrangler is a... Yeah.
Endured, yeah.
The dream job.
But yeah, so this was the first time I'd read it.
Mm.
So what are your memories of it from can you remember how old you were when you read it?
I think I read it a few times, but I was probably I don't know, say 9 to 11. I know it's about the same time I was reading A Little Princess by Frances Hodgson Burnett, which I didn't realise this at the time, but The Wolves of Willoughby Chase is sort of a semi-pastiche of that kind of book.
So what's A Little Princess?
Okay, so A Little Princess was written in 1905, and it's about a girl called Sarah Crewe, who's grown up in India with her adoring father, but is then sent away to a boarding school in England, where at first she's treated with great indulgence and respect because her father's so rich, but he so suddenly suddenly dies in an accident, and it turns out he had mountains of debt, so she like loses all her status and all her toys and clothes and everything, and is made to live in the attic and work for a living in this boarding school. It also has a happy ending, and I am faltering because I haven't actually read the book in a long time, and I've played instead A Little Lily Princess, which is a visual novel based on A Little Princess, but has different and rather more lesbian endings.
Yes.
Which, so I can't remember the canonical ending.
But because lesbian endings are intruding upon your consciousness.
Yes. And like, and then she is gay. No, that's not how it originally ended. But,
The thing Wolves of Willoughby Chase reminded me of was, do you remember when my old housemate Stu used to do a puppet show called The Little Dying Orphans?
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember one of the orphans having to survive by eating their lung peas, which were little green bits of their lung they'd cut up.
The orphanage and... particularly in the film, is very little dying orphans. More so in the film. I don't think any of them actually die in the book.
No, there's some proper death in the films. So the film, I mean, we're not quite talking Marianne Dreams into Paper House.
Mm.
You know, when the film was a 15 and you have this sort of almost adult interpretation or adaptation of the book.
Yeah.
This is still a kid's film.
Yeah.
I would say. But very much in the 1980s dark fantasy vein. It doesn't hold back on the killing.
No. I was quite surprised by how good the film was.
Yeah, same here. I don't know why I wasn't expecting much.
Mm. I don't know. I sort of expected it to be a bit stuffy and a bit dull, but actually...
Yeah, a bit made for television, maybe. Mm.
But it's actually, when I watched it on YouTube, and the next thing that auto-played afterwards was A Box of Delights.
That makes sense.
And yeah. I was like, yeah, okay, that... These are very much a similar style of thing. I know we'll talk about Box of Delights at some point, probably.
Oh, I'm sure, because that is one that I remember from childhood.
Yeah.
My granddad recorded it on audio cassette for me when I was little. So I remember all the business with squabbling people.
Squabbling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, this film was probably made on a budget, as is often the way now, this meant picking up sticks and filming on location in Prague.
Oh, really?
So, if you check the credits, this is filmed at Barrandov Studios.
Huh.
So it's the luscious forests of Bohemia.
Oh, wow.
Which actually made a lot of sense after when I discovered that, because it looks quite similar to some kind of Czech fairy tale films from the 60s,
mm-hmm.
Like Three Nuts for Cinderella. It reminded me of quite a bit, which is a lovely film. I don't think it's quite dark enough, sadly, to justify talking about this podcast.
Yeah.
That very kind of deep snow you get. I mean, you know, I think even by the 1980s, you probably wouldn't get snowfall like that over here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Some interesting casting. Mel Smith of Smith and Jones being in it as one of the villains.
Yep.
Looking quite a lot like Robbie Coltrane, I thought.
Yeah, he did. I don't know who played Lord Willoughby, but he did look a bit like you.
What? I don't think you're thinking of me. I think you're thinking of my long lost uncle Gerald Rumpus Nubbins.
Maybe I am. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He looked a bit like Gerald Rumpus Nubbins. I'd agree to that.
Definitely need to talk about. Stephanie Beecham as Miss Slycarp.
Oh, yeah, she's kind of like Angelica Houston in The Witches.
Well, yeah. I also thought she's kind of doing a bit of a Nicolas Cage in this film.
Oh, why did you think that?
I just think, like, she just seems to take every opportunity to just, like, camp it up and, like, put in just, like, strange, like, little flourishes.
Yeah, yeah, it's a very kind of gesture-y mannered performance. It's pretty great.
She's very vampy. She's much fair bit younger than you'd imagine from the book, or at least that I imagined. Maybe influenced by the illustrations, which don't suggest a young woman particularly. But yeah, she likes to appear silhouetted in doorways. there's just sort of moments where you see her just sort of, one of the girls comes across from the house just kind of dancing alone to herself. Kind of.
there's a bit of her in the bath just marring herself in the mirror while sort of singing this strange ditty.
Well, she's kind of trilling to herself.
That's a good, trilling is the right word,
I think. It's a very interesting noise. And speaking of Angelica Houston, we get the idea in the film that she's completely bald as a witch in The Witches.
Which, as one of the YouTube commentators suggested, might be a signifier that she's got syphilis.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's interesting.
Which would make sense with its sort of Victorian period setting.
There's also an interestingly sexual undertone to her character, which isn't in the book, as she sort of seems to be having some kind of dalliance with both Mr. Grimshaw and Mrs. Brisket, in my opinion.
There's just a general large amount of randiness with all the villains seem randy somehow.
Yeah, they do.
In a sort of unwholesome sort of way.
Yeah, I mean, there's a bit where where sort of Miss Lycup is like sitting, reclining in a chair with Mrs. Brisket sitting between her thighs and like stroking her hair. Mr. Grimshaw is a very lechy drunk as well.
And it's got an interesting thing with the kind of kids spying on them and sort of knowing but not knowing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like that. It's like, it's not exactly that the kids are naive, it's more the, like, adults.
Yeah.
Before I say that the two child performers are really good as well.
Yeah, they are.
Just exceptionally well cast.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's one of those films where, you know, miscasting could have really sunk it.
No, I was really surprised. I was really pleased by how much Bonnie both looked and acted like I imagined her in the book.
Yeah, definitely. That she's a scamp. A sort of scamp and a rascal.
Yeah. Although they have a slightly more, a slightly more realistic relationship in the film than in the book. But they're slightly more antagonistic towards each other.
Yeah, that's true. I think in the book, the two cousins are sort of immediately on side and best of friends, whereas, you know, they're personality-wise very, very different, so I guess it would make sense that they wouldn't immediately get on.
Yeah, Sylvia's very, mild-mannered and has been brought up by her eminently respectable Aunt Jane.
He's fallen on hard times, but still wants to, you know, keep the levels of respectability up. Mm.
One of her pieces of advice to Sylvia as she put her on the train is try to avoid abstract nouns. They upset people. which I mean, enjoyed.
Sylvia definitely feels the most kind of transplanted out of Dickens.
Yes.
I think. Yeah.
Apart from possibly poor orphan Joey, who is sacrificed to the waters of the laundry.
That's awful. So yeah, there's this poor little, very cute little orphan, little Joey, who is horribly drowned.
Yeah.
Until death.
Yeah.
Like I was really banking on him actually being okay.
I know.
And it's awful because he gets like the cloth. You know, I guess they're cleaning or dyeing cloth, is it?
Yeah, I think they're washing it. Yeah.
And he gets it caught over his head.
Yeah.
And so as he's drowning, he's struggling to get free, and this cloth is kind of like pulled down over his face like a death shroud.
Yeah.
Really quite upsetting image.
Mm.
And to say he's a very little child and looks little.
Yes.
So yeah, I was quite shocked by that. And then shortly after, a rather less sympathetic older boy called Rupert is rolled to death.
Yeah. So he's Mrs. Brisket's son, who's deputised to keep the orphans in order. And he's crushed to death in the giant laundry mangle.
To the jubilance of the children, I will note.
Yeah.
I think the book is a little bit more merciful than the film.
Yeah, I think so. I mentioned this to Alex, and they said, "Oh, I've always wanted to go through a laundry mangle." So, as well as desire to be a mouse. Another.
Well, so if Alex does get transformed into a mouse, you know what to do about that. No, don't do that.
I wouldn't. But,
even if Alex is squeaking to be put in the mangle, don't do it.
But yeah, once... So Mrs. Slycop goes in to deliver the news of her son's death to Mrs. Brisket, and with the compassionate response, "Rupert's dead, get used to it."
Yeah, that felt a bit ad-libbed, I thought.
Yeah. I forgot to mention, God, this is one of my notes I wrote while watching the film, was Constance the Beef Brisket.
What?
Well, you know, Beef Brisket.
Oh.
Like the dish. Yeah.
Oh.
I thought that could be a cool nickname for her.
if she was in a gang.
Yeah. Constance the Beef Brisket.
Or like the Mafia.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to write some kind of fanfic spin-off.
Yeah.
Yeah. There are lots of just really good lines added into the script of the film.
Yeah,
actually.
There are. I was about to say, like, when she's first introduced, she like opens the big iron door and says, "My name is Mrs. Brisket, and my word is law."
There's also some pretty horrible talk the villains really enjoy scaring the kids and saying that children have been forced to eat their own vomit.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which was particularly unpleasant.
Yeah.
I think one of my favourite retorts, though, is actually from Bonnie, which is, she's been, you mentioned before, she's locked up in the cupboard. And understandably, you know, it's pitch black there. She seems to be crying. And Sylvia comes up and says, "Oh, don't cry, Bonnie." And she says, "I'm not crying. I'm laughing with joy and not having to see her horrible face."
Yeah.
Like, Bonnie throws a lot of shade, basically, in this film. Like, there's a great bit slightly earlier when Sylvia says, "Don't let's quarrel. It's unchristian." And the look Bonnie gives her is amazing.
Yeah. I noticed that too.
So yeah, this film's in its entirety on YouTube, and I suspect it might be quite hard to come by otherwise.
Yes, it says it has Spanish subtitles, but actually it doesn't.
Well, I think it does if you put the subtitles on.
Okay.
So, you know, whether you can read Spanish or not, either way, you can watch and enjoy it, because it is really, really is quite good.
Yeah.
I also watched some of it because I've been quite busy the last week and I wanted to get through it. I will admit to watching some of it at 1.25 speed. And it is the only film I've ever watched where that did not detract at all. If anything, it just added to the kind of manic energy of the film.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that must have been actually quite an experience.
Yeah, yeah.
There's quite a good chase sequence at the end with wolves and Miss Lycarp and Mrs. Brisket on sort of steam-powered... What even are they? I don't know.
Like some kind of... It's like a steam-powered mini train that's not on tracks.
Yeah.
And not only does she get exploded, she then gets eaten by wolves. Because yeah. For this film, you know, to be fair, I guess, you know, we've already mangled to death a boy who is just a bit mean.
Yeah.
So, you know, for the main villain of the piece, you know, you have to up the ante, I guess.
Yeah. And she also throws knives at Bonnie.
Oh, yeah.
Just before they set her on fire.
Which does look a little bit dangerous for the child actor involved, I thought.
Yeah, is this one of these things where the child actor's later is like, "I genuinely feared for my life."
Yeah.
Like the little girl in Baron Munchausen.
Oh, I don't know about that.
Yes, no, apparently Terry Gilliam was not at all concerned for her safety during the filming of that one.
I think the early 80s in particular was a very bad time, actually, for the health and safety of child actors.
Mm.
I know that the death filming the Twilight Zone movie, which was produced by Spielberg, like, made a big change in, like, child acting labour laws, basically. Because I think, in the early 80s, it does feel like there are more and more kind of big special effects in these kind of family kids films with child actors having to do some very dangerous stuff. It's good that it was cut back on, really.
Yes. So the other thing, so I put a couple of as we were talking about themes that we've discovered in children's horror in our last episode, I made a few notes about that. We were talking about transformation of houses, of like the home from a place of comfort into a place of horror, which is definitely present in The Wolves of Willoughby Chase.
I mean, in the film, the home is established early on as a real place of family and comfort. You know, you see all the servants working happily together and, it's shown to be, you know, a really warm, inclusive domestic space, rightly or wrongly, you know?
Yeah. That we see Miss Lycarp, transforming it into, well, first getting rid of her, Bonnie's toys and luxuries and dismissing all the most of the servants and then turning it into a horrible boarding school. Although I think that there's a bit of comfort in the secret passages in the house, which sort of seems like the house being on the children's side a bit.
In the film, there's also, I rather like this because I remember doing things like this as a kid. The two girls try to walk around the kind of upper edge of the room without touching the floor, like scampering over the wardrobes and things. And they do that again when the room has been stripped of its toys. And I think Body remarks, well, at least it makes it easier to play this game or something.
Yeah, I like that too, because that's definitely... I don't know if I've played that exact game, but I might have done. Like, it's very familiar kind of thing.
Yeah, and very true to how children transform everyday spaces.
Mm. Yeah. And the other thing that's particularly relevant is monstrous authority figures, which we have a trio of, although Mr. Grimshaw is a bit not so much monstrous as greedy and a bit pathetic, really.
Gross,
yeah. but Mrs. Brisket and Miss Lycarp are completely merciless.
Oh yeah, they have. They're all about suffer the little children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they seem to revel in the fact that children have no power and no one to turn to protect them.
Yeah. Yeah, they're very much like the kind of worst of Dickens's villains, basically.
Mm.
Like, you know, a sort of Mr. Squeers or something.
Mm. And then, of course, the other source of horror is the wolves themselves, of which there are less in the book, but they definitely make their presence known. And there's the kind of horror of the sort of kind of oddness of them being there, like the sort of, because it's very similar to, you know, actual, well, setting of Victorian England, but
so fictionalized Dickensian Victorian England.
But then there's this difference that sort of, I don't know, it feels quite creepy.
Mm.
And there's, I don't know if you wanted to read the part where Sylvia is on the train and a wolf jumps through the window.
Sure. She woke suddenly from one of these dreams to find that the train had stopped with a jerk. Oh, what is it? Where are we? She exclaimed before she could stop herself. No need to alarm yourself, miss, said her companion, looking unavailingly out of the black square of window. Wolves are the line, most likely. They often have trouble of that kind hereabouts. Wolves? Sylvia stared at him in terror. Oh, they don't often get into the train, though, he added reassuringly. 2 years ago, they managed to climb into the guard's van and eat a pig. And once they got the engine driver, another had to be sent in a relief engine. But they don't often eat a passenger, I promise you. As if in contradiction of his words, a sad and sinister howling now arose beyond the windows. And Sylvia, pressing her face against the dark pane, saw that they were passing through a thickly wooded region where snow lay deep on the ground. Across this white carpet, she could just discern a ragged multitude pouring, out of which arose, from time to time, this terrible cry. She was almost petrified with fear, and sat clutching Annabelle in a cold and trembling hand. At length, she summoned up strength to whisper, "Why don't we go on?" "No, I expect there are too many of them on the line ahead," the man answered carelessly. "Can't just push through them, you see. The engine would be derailed in no time. And then we should be in a bad way. No, I'll expect we'll have to wait here till daylight now. The wolves will get scared then, you know, and make for home. All that matters is that the driver shan't get eaten in the meantime. He'll keep them off by throwing lumps of coal at them, I dare say." "Oh," Sylvia exclaimed in irrepressible alarm as a heavy body thudded suddenly against the window and she had a momentary view of a pointed grey head, red slathering jaws and pale eyes gleaming with ferocity. "Oh, don't worry about that," soothed her companion. "They'll keep up that jumping against the windows for hours. They're not much danger, you know, singly. It's only in the whole pack you've got to watch out for them." Sylvia was not much comforted by this. She moved along to the middle of the seat and huddled there, glancing fearfully first to one side and then to the other. The strange man seemed quite undisturbed by the repeated onslaught of the wolves which followed. He took a pinch of snuff, remarked that it was all a great nuisance and they would be late, and composed himself to sleep again. He had just begun to snore, and a discomposing incident occurred. The window beside him, which must have been insecurely fastened, was not proof against the continuous impact of the frenzied and ravenous animals. The catch suddenly slipped, and the window fell open with a crash, its glass shivering into fragments. Sylvia screamed. Another instant, and a wolf precipitated itself through the aperture thus formed. It turned, snarling on the sleeping stranger, who started awake with an oath and very adroitly flung his cloak over the animal. He then seized one of the shattered pieces of glass lying on the floor and stabbed the imprisoned beast through the cloak. It fell dead. "Tush," said Sylvia's companion, breathing heavily and passing his hand over his face. "Oh, unexpected. Most." He extracted the dead wolf from the folds of the cloak and tipped its body, with some exertion, out through the broken window. There was a chorus of the snarling and yelping outside, and then the wolves seemed to take fright at the appearance of their dead comrade, for Sylvia saw them coursing away over the snow.
Yeah.
And it happens very abruptly. I think that's the thing with the fright and danger in this book, is it comes about all of a sudden that the scene might be quite cosy and tranquil, and then suddenly there's a wolf snapping at your throat.
Yeah. It also seems shows a more presence of mind and quick reflexes than you kind of expect from Mr. Grimshaw, given the rest of his characterisation.
Yeah, it's odd, reading, you know, looking back at the character after reading it and what we know of him.
Because,
You know, at first we don't know whether he's a villain or quite who he is.
Yeah.
And why he's taking an interest in Sylvia. Did remind me a bit, actually. Yeah, you mentioned Box of Delights, obviously, with the television series. It starts on the train with the sinister priest showing off his magic tricks.
Yeah.
The boy, it reminded me a little bit of that.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I quite like that we can't read, in even reading it back, it's hard to know whether on some level he is trying to comfort Sylvia or whether he's actually trying to frighten her even more through this sort of false play of comfort, which I think is what's going on.
Yeah.
You know, because he's like, oh, don't worry, you know, last time they only ate the engine driver.
And
it probably won't happen again.
Yeah. Yeah, it's certainly quite an interesting one.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, I think generally has quite frightening rhythms, basically.
Mm.
The book, because it does sort of work in fits and starts, and things kind of get bad or turn worse at unexpected moments.
Mm.
Which works well for children's horror. I think that feeling of things being out of your control.
Yeah.
Right. And having to live according to the rhythms of the adult world, come what may.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to say, in a way, it kind of felt like a sort of inverted Water Babies.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the Water Babies, right, I guess our main protagonist, is it Tom in the Water Babies?
Yeah.
You know, is sort of wild and unruly and, well, you know, it's because of his impoverished upbringing. But, you know, he needs to kind of be disciplined into goodness.
Yeah.
Whereas in the Wolves Willoughby Chase, I think discipline is often looked at askance or seen as just being an excuse for sadism and power to be exercised.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's true.
That, like, Mr. Willoughby, is it Mr. Willoughby himself?
Lord Willoughby.
Lord Willoughby himself, you know, seems quite keen on a bit of chaos. You know, he's quite happy for this boy to live in a cave sort of at the end of his garden, basically, and has offered him gainful employment. But the boy says he'd rather just, you know, feed his geese and
live off chestnuts.
Lord Willoughby's like, yeah, fine, if you want.
And I mean, Bonnie's like wildness is actually proves to be quite useful to her and to Sylvia, that she's not submissive to authority.
It saves their skin many times, basically. Which also, I think, just makes this a lot more fun than the water babies. With the water babies, you know, you feel like you're constantly being lectured. Whereas there's no, you know, be good as you would be done by. I mean, you know, if there's a moral, I mean, you know, it obviously it probably shouldn't be greedy and be horrible to children, but it generally feels like a romp, a kind of mini silly Dickensian epic, I think.
Yeah. Shall we do texture of the week?
Okay.
Texture.
I was going for sort of old timey, I don't know, like, you know, like in a church, maybe.
Yeah,
sort of Victorian, I think. Yeah.
Did you hear I had a natural instrument that time?
Oh, it was a natural instrument. I thought it was keys.
No, it was a little shaker.
Little shaker?
A little shaker.
not a salt shaker?
No, a natural, a musical shaker.
Is it in the shape of a whimsical animal or creature?
No, it's very sensible. It's not whimsical at all.
Oh, sorry, it's a sensible shaker.
But you it has a little rubber band to stick it to your finger.
Oh, okay. That's good. That's very sensible.
Yeah. My texture of the week, I was going to be the soap made out of the late Mr. Brisket. We have already mentioned that. I did also quite enjoy the orphans like punching through a thick layer of ice to wash their faces in the morning.
Oh, that's rather nice. Yeah. Mm. I thought it was going to be the mangling, like the roller.
Well, so. Yes.
you just didn't want to be to type.
Yeah.
I found, I mean, this is more kind of sensory, perhaps, than it is textural. So I'm maybe bending the rules a little bit. But I really like this little piece of writing here, just in terms of, yeah, the smells and the colours it brings up. There's no light lying with sheep 2-3 days for a chesty cough, pronounced Mr. Wilderness. The breath of sheep is a powerful virtue in it. That and a brew of my cherry bark syrup, with maybe a spoonful of honey in it, and a plateful of 2 or good porridge, will set her to rights better than the grandest doctor in the kingdom. I thought cherry bark syrup was really lovely.
Oh, yeah. Also, actually, there was Sylvia being laid down to sleep on a moving bed of geese, which was quite good.
Despite all the horribleness, there is some really lovely descriptive writing in it, too.
So I just wanted to do a shout out to my friend and our dedicated listener Eric in Greece, who's been listening to this podcast while recovering from a heart transplant. Also a very appropriate episode, as he has a particular affinity with wolves. But yeah, get well soon, Eric.
Oh, get well soon.
Any further thoughts?
Just one last thing. That in the film, Bonnie's mother comments, "Oh, I almost wished we'd stayed on the island," which I thought was a little bit mean.
Yeah. Our intro music is by Maki Yamazaki. Our outro music is by Joe Kelly. Our artwork is by Letty Wilson. You can find us on Twitter at StillScaredPod or email us at StillScaredPodcast@gmail.com. Write us a review on iTunes if you think we're good. Thanks.
I mean, you have the right to do it if you think we're bad.
Yeah, you do. We can't stop you.
But I mean, freedom of speech.
But we'd rather you didn't.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if truth be told, obviously. Bye, spooky kids. Don't make soap out of any orphans.
Yeah. Events in this podcast should not be replicated at home.
Bye.
We'll see you next time. Bye.